Are we all complicit in slavery, disease, and death of workers overseas?
So we're all kind of caught up in this web of globalization, denial of human rights, worker occupational illness and disease, and our product choices.
That's Heather White. We talk with her about her explosive undercover look at the deadly hazards in China's electronics industry. Her film is called Complicit. Then, what will it take to end slavery and other human rights abuses in the fashion industry?
I believe that if one of the really big companies decided to make part of its masthead promise, social responsibility is at the core of what we do. I think that if a big company made, you know, the first step to say, we're going to make this part of our core promise to consumers, I think everybody else would get in line.
That's best-selling author Corbin Addison. We talk with him about his gripping new novel, A Harvest of Thorns. It's a thriller that reveals the ugly underbelly of fast fashion. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. How much pain does it take for a multinational corporation to become a more responsible corporate citizen? That's the question at the core of Corbin Addison's new novel, Harvest of Thorns. When a terrible fire claims the lives of hundreds of garment workers in Bangladesh, one of America's largest retailers confronts a painful choice. Does it do the right thing and enforce the ethical standards it says it demands from its suppliers? Or does it serve the demands of its stockholders and ignore worker rights in favor of short-term profits? Two protagonists clash over the question, the company's compliance officer and a crusading journalist whose career is under a cloud. The lives of three workers and thousands of their co-workers are at stake. This isn't the first time Corbin Addison has used fiction to explore the theme of social justice. His novel, A Walk Across the Sun, is about human trafficking, and The Garden of Burning Sand tells a human rights story set in Zambia. But A Harvest of Thorns brings it all home as it confronts the reader with just how our endless appetite for cheap and ever-changing fashions is destroying the lives of the people who make our clothes. Corbin Addison says he was inspired by a video he saw about the 2012 Tazreen Fashions factory fire in Bangladesh, where more than 100 workers died.
So I created a fictional facsimile in many ways of the Tazreen Fashions factory in Dhaka. So during the research, I traveled around the world, and one of the places that I went to do the research was to Dhaka, to the Ashulia district in northern Dhaka, and I sat, you know, in a room with some of the women who survived the Tazreen fire in 2012, and looking, you know, actually we were looking out the window at the burned out hulk of the Tazreen Fashions factory, which has still not been repurposed. But my understanding was that actually the owner at the time was he had gotten out of jail through political connections and was trying to restart the factory, despite the fact that under his employ, hundreds of people had died and been injured. So I had the thought, okay, well, I'm going to create a story that starts with a fictitious but fact-based rendering of this fire. And so in many ways, the Millennium Fashions factory in my book is Tazreen, you know, down to the details of the number of floors it has and the central stairwell and the barricades on the windows and the lack of fire extinguishers and the lack of a fire escape and all the things that turn Tazreen into a charnel house. And that's really how the book begins, with, you know, with a short in a wall socket that is poorly maintained, that spreads to flammables on the ground, and of course all of the cuttings of t-shirts and jeans and stuff, all of it's cotton and all of it is super flammable, and that spreads to generators and causes an explosion and spreads up the central stairwell, blocking the only escape for the nearly 1,000 workers who are working in the factory. And so they have to do what the women of Tazreen did, which is break down the barricades on the windows and jump, hoping that gravity is kinder than flames.
and a young girl dies. She's 14 years old, and her sister survives, but is lying on the ground for quite some time, and there's a photograph that goes around the world with a child's pair of pants with the brand name on a label that's seen everywhere. Now, the factory was supposedly not authorized by the company that has this brand to make these clothes because of safety concerns that they had. The company's name, Presto. So how did it come about that they were producing this?
Yeah, I actually took that also from real life. Tazreen was making clothes on the night of the Tazreen fire in 2012 for Walmart. And in the aftermath of the fire, the New York Times ran a couple of stories about that very thing and asked Walmart, you know, how could you be making your clothes in what was essentially a death trap? And Walmart's corporate response was, we did not know our clothes were being made at Tazreen. We did not authorize that factory to make our clothes. It must have been subcontracted from our primary supplier. And that was where the story ended. I mean, the New York Times pressed them for more information, and Walmart never gave any more information. They just basically passed the buck to their primary supplier, which, when I read that story and I, you know, did some digging, it sounded farcical. I mean, how is it possible that a company that sophisticated could be so unsophisticated and not really know where its clothes were being made? And then the more I looked into it, the more I realized that this is actually the way that, you know, shockingly, a lot of the clothes are made in the world. The supply chains for clothing are so complex and stretch all the way around the world and involve so many different countries and so many thousands. I mean, for Walmart, 100,000 different suppliers. There's no way they can keep track of all levels of the supply chain. They certainly know who's getting the primary order. So their buyers, their buying agents go out and make an order in, you know, one or more factories in a particular country for a particular, you know, order, whatever it is, pants, shirts, dresses. So they know that. But what often happens, what happened in Tazreen and what I used in my book, is subcontracting. So the manufacturer at the top, it's got a big factory, and they have a certain capacity. They can make a certain number of pieces per month. They have a number of lines, and their job in order to make money is to use those lines efficiently. Well, when a Walmart comes or a Presto in my book comes along, the manufacturer is not going to say no to an order. They've got to keep the orders coming, so they always say yes. Then there's a game of kind of, you know, shuffle that happens, where they try to figure out how they're going to actually fulfill the order, the number of pieces and the time. And very often, these orders have last-minute changes from the brand that screw things up in the lines, you know, and very often, subcontracting is, in fact, required in order to get these orders to the port on time. So, you know, in Tazreen, as in my story, what happens is the manufacturer that got the order from the brand actually was required in order to fulfill it to subcontract through multiple layers. And in my story, one of those down the food chain was Millennium Fashions, which is the factory in my book. They were required in order to fulfill the order for Presto, and even though they were not authorized. And that's very often what happens in Bangladesh and various other countries. The brand might have a list of factories they prefer to deal with, but when it comes to getting the order fulfilled on time, the manufacturers, the suppliers, don't care that much about the brand's list. They care much more about fulfilling the order, and that often ends in a scenario where the brand doesn't actually know where its clothes are being made.
So explain this, Corbin Addison. Why this kind of pressure? I mean, if the companies, you know, have set up these monitoring systems to say which factories are safe and which ones are not, why so much of a pressure to make sure that they get these clothes done on schedule, on their schedule? What's driving that schedule? Why can't producers say to them, you're going to have to wait a couple of weeks until we can find the factory to do it the right way?
Yeah, so this actually sets up the great dilemma and the great tension that lies at the heart of the garment-making process in today's world. At the heart of the fashion, you call it fashion apparel garment industry, doesn't really matter. At the heart of it is this tension between the business side, which is producing new lines of clothing, it seems, especially in fast fashion and discount fashion. It's no longer quarterly. It's no longer seasonal. It's like every week, every couple weeks, there's new stuff in the store. And so the people on the sourcing side and inside the brands, their job is to create new apparel that people will buy at a kind of breathtaking rate, new stuff constantly, new designs constantly. And so the price pressure and the time pressure for them is what they apply to get what they want, you know, at lower and lower prices, because they're being driven by two things. They have to keep consumers happy, and consumers want diversity. They want stuff that's exciting, new stuff, and they want it for cheap. And so sourcing has to keep consumers happy. And at the end of the day, they have to answer to the executives, who answer to the board, who answers to the shareholders, and the shareholders want higher and higher profits, right? So we have to keep the orders coming. We've got to continue squeezing cost so we keep our consumers happy by keeping the prices low, but we keep our investors happy by keeping the share price high. So on the one hand, you've got sourcing, who's constantly clamoring for faster and faster turnaround times, lower and lower prices. And on the other side of the business, you have corporate social responsibility and compliance and legal. And they're the people who are saying, well, look, you can't just keep driving prices lower and lower, because what you're actually doing is you're hurting the human beings and the environment in the process. And so there are standards, and we have our codes of conduct, and we have to have our suppliers get audited, and all of these things, you know, that are trying to keep the standards higher. That tension is at the heart of every single brand in existence, with the exception of a few, like Patagonia, who have built social responsibility into their DNA, and they just sell stuff for more money, and their customers are willing to pay more. But if you're in fast fashion, if you're in discount fashion, consumers don't want to pay more. And investors, you know, if you're a public company, investors want those profits. And so that tension is what, in fact, drives the core narrative in my story and really, you know, in the industry. You know, what happens when a company has these kind of competing interests? You know, what happens to the suppliers, that is, the companies on the ground who are actually making the clothes in a place like Bangladesh or a place like Malaysia or in a place like Jordan or dozens of other countries? What happens to them in the middle of that dilemma when they're getting pressure from both sides? Well, what happens is they'll do their best to make both sides happy. So they'll tell the corporate people, the sourcing people, yeah, we'll get it. We'll get the order done. We'll do what you want. We will take the cost that you're offering, even though it's killing us, even though we're not making a profit anymore. We'll find a way to make it work. And then on the other hand, they'll say to the CSR folks who come in to audit, oh yeah, we'll make sure that our factory is you know, safe and sound, is shipshape, but we're going to wink, wink, and nod, nod, and kind of hide the ball, because there's simply no way for us to turn a profit to make, you know, to keep both sides happy without lying about it. And that's unfortunately ultimately what happens in a lot of cases. There's a tremendous amount of fraud that goes on in order to keep the orders coming. And I lay the buck at the feet of the brands. They're the ones with the power, and they're the ones that are giving these mixed messages to the suppliers.
Yeah, I mean, and your company seems in some ways, you know, it's definitely not the worst kind of company. It's not a cartoon villain. The CEO of the company seems to want to make it right, do the right thing. And he's got a chief legal counsel who's driving much of the narrative. Tell us about Cameron.
You're right. I mean, I tried to create a company that has a conscience as much as a for-profit public company can. I tried to create a company that came from the roots of a private family business, you know, that was interested in selling quality stuff for less, which is really the roots of a lot of companies, including Walmart. So I tried to create a company that wasn't going to just be a cartoon villain. And that, frankly, you know, as all companies are, they're made up of human beings, right? So the corporation is not a monolith. A corporation has lots of different human beings with different consciences and different experiences and different, you know, appetites for social responsibility inside of it. So, you know, the CEO is not a bad guy, though he's got some blind spots, and he's obviously beholden to his board and his shareholders, you know, for profits, as I described earlier. But his best friend and his chief legal officer, his general counsel, is Cameron Alexander. And Cameron, you know, while he and Vance, the CEO, went to Harvard Business School together, Cameron is somebody who is really passionate about compliance. He's passionate about making sure that Presto, the corporation, has a soul and a conscience. And frankly, that's his job. I mean, as general counsel, his job is to maintain the reputation of the firm. So, you know, when the fire happens at Millennium and this photo that you described of little Sonia on the ground, you know, lying unconscious outside of the burning factory goes viral around the world, one of the people who sees the video footage is Cameron inside of Vance's office in the Presto Tower back in Virginia. And it's shocking to everybody inside of Presto because, I mean, who in the world wants your label, you know, over the face of a girl who might be dead, you don't know at the time, in front of an inferno. It's just a horrifying reality. But the people inside Presto have different responses. Cameron's response as a lawyer, as general counsel, as the guardian of the reputation of the company, is to say a couple of things. Number one, we need to protect ourselves. And number two, we need to look into this and figure out what happened. And that ultimately is that question, what happened, and then how can we prevent this from happening again, is what gets him involved in an investigation that ends up taking him places he never dreamed that he would end up going.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with best-selling author Corbin Addison about his latest novel, A Harvest of Thorns. It's about the fast fashion industry and how it hurts workers. Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, obviously we can't give anything away, and this is a real page-turner, by the way. It's a very gripping read. But there is a choice, ultimately, in the book to do something on the individual company level and to do something on the industry-wide level by bringing a suit. So talk a little bit about the tension between those two solutions.
So the other side of the equation in the book, it's really driven by two main characters. One is Cameron, who's on the inside of the firm of Presto. And then there's a two-time Pulitzer-winning but now disgraced journalist from the Washington Post, Josh Griswold, who has a clandestine meeting, the Lincoln Memorial, with a source from inside Presto that gives him confidential information about what happened with the fire. And actually some other stuff, some nasty business going on inside of Presto and Presto supply chains in their garment-making business and in their clothing. So Josh then takes this information. It's basically just a gift. As very often, you know, good journalists will, because of their position, they'll get information and then they develop it, kind of like Deep Throat and some of the stories like Watergate, you know, that we've heard in real life. So a journalist, in this case, gets some information and develops that information by doing an investigation around the world. But the interesting thing is that the source asked Josh to do something different with it. It wasn't just, look, take this to the newspapers, take it to CNN and put it on television, because the source recognized, and as I think is true today, that the media, you know, while it has power, is very often distractible, and stories live and die, you know, very often in a breath, in a day or two, as in fact the story of the fire did in this case. You know, it was there just like it was with Tazreen in the New York Times. It was there for a couple of weeks and then it was gone. What the source really wanted in my story is change. And in order to get change, a company like Presto has to feel pain. Actually, I started the story in my mind with a question, and that is how much pain would it take for a company, a $65 billion public company, to revisit and reevaluate its core business model when it came to retail. And my answer was an enormous amount of pain. So One of the ways that pain can be brought is through, you know, litigation. And so what ultimately Josh does with the information is he brings a lawsuit. He, together with some other lawyers, bring a lawsuit against Presto in order to expose the truth about what happened at the Millennium Fire and in some other parts of Presto's supply chain that include human trafficking and forced labor, things that are happening even today inside of the supply chains of brands around the world, including some of the best brands. And so that, you know, that's kind of changed from without. So the story presents, you know, two different faces, as you mentioned. There's kind of a campaign for change from within and then a campaign for change from without. And those two collide in ways that I don't want to give away. But as you mentioned, you know, I think it makes for a pretty gripping read.
There are really three stories in this book, one that takes place in Dhaka, Bangladesh, another one that takes place in Malaysia, and a third in Jordan. And I know that you have previously written about and been involved with the whole issue of human trafficking. So fold that into our discussion here. Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. So actually, the original idea, the very core kernel, the inspiration for this story was an idea my wife gave me some years back to write a story about the other side of human trafficking. So in my first published novel, A Walk Across the Sun, I dealt with sex trafficking, essentially, you know, forced prostitution of women and girls around the world. The other side of human trafficking is forced labor inside the supply chains of the things that we all love to buy and wear. It can be clothing, it can be rug making, it can be furniture, it can be agriculture. I mean, and it happens all over the world. So I thought it was a good idea. So, you know, there's a tainted goods list that the Department of Labor publishes, the U.S. Department of Labor, and that list is published every couple of years, and it shows all the different industries where there is evidence of child labor and forced labor and the countries in which it's found, in which we have evidence. So, and it, you just go down the list of goods and services that are touched by forced labor, and it's shocking, just the number of things that I could have picked. I mean, coffee and chocolate and toys, and I mean, it's just, you just go down the list of things that we buy in stores, sight unseen, that could very well could have been made by a slave, you know, or someone in a condition of forced labor. But what I came to over and over again was garments. And so when I thought about this story, I thought, you know, I want to write something that really touches everybody, you know, that gets the reader hooked early and because of its relevance, because not everybody drinks coffee. A lot of people do. But, you know, that isn't quite as meaningful and quite as, you know, immediate as the clothes on our backs. I mean, all of us are being touched literally 99% of our lives by the things that are being made, you know, by the garment industry. And so I decided to write a story that focuses on clothing. And I wanted to touch on a number of different things. So the Dhaka story, the Millennium Fashion story, is about fire safety. And then in Malaysia and Jordan, to some extent, I touch on forced labor. And so what happens, and I went to Malaysia, I went to Jordan, and I met with people, workers who had been victims of forced labor who were making clothing even then, in factories for big American brands and big European brands. And they all told the same story about what happened. And so I wove this into my book. It's basically a form of fraudulent recruitment. So, you know, in poor countries around the globe, people are looking for work. And if they can't find it in their own country, they will go abroad and they will subject themselves to all kinds of indignities in order to send money home. They'll buy any story that labor brokers sell them about a good job overseas. And so what often happens, and what happened in my story and what happens in real life, is a labor broker will go to a village in a place like Bangladesh, where, in fact, they're number one in that country. Their number one export is clothing, and their number two export is people. They send so many young Bangladeshis abroad to do work in factories. So the labor brokers come with a story. We've got a factory in such and such country, say Malaysia, which is what I used, and they're willing to pay you, you know, this number of U.S. dollars, you know, or the equivalent in Bangladeshi currency per month for, you know, X number of hours of work. They'll take care of your housing. They'll put food on your table, and then you'll be able to send, you know, money home. But In order to get there, you've got to give us a certain amount of money up front. It's the recruitment fee. Well, the recruitment fee is usually too expensive for poor people who are willing to go abroad for work to pay. So the only way they pay it is through a loan. So they don't go to a bank for the loan. They go to a loan shark in a place like Dhaka or Chittagong. And the loan shark gives them, you know, the loan secured by whatever land this person's family can put up. So usually it's literally the only wealth they might have. Their parent, their uncle might have a piece of land, and they secure the recruitment loan with that land. And then they go abroad. They go overseas, they get there, and very often what happens, and what happens in my story, is the young worker will be required to give their passport and their work visa to their handler. It might be a local broker, it might be somebody, a manager in the factory, it doesn't matter. Ultimately, they give up their documents, and they are required under the terms of their contract, which was often written in a language they don't understand, that is English. They are required to stay there for usually 1 year to 3 years on pain. If they do not fulfill the terms of their contract, they will not only forfeit their recruitment loan and get deported, but that loan will then be enforced against the property that is their family's only wealth. And so they are effectively tied to this job for the length of the contract. There's no way for them to leave. And under many circumstances, they are not paid what they were told they were going to get paid. There are all kinds of hidden fees that deplete what they're actually earning. And so I met people in Malaysia, young Bangladeshi workers in Malaysia, working to make clothes for Adidas and Reebok and, you know, Ralph Lauren Polo in a decent factory. But they had been recruited under fraudulent conditions and had worked for multiple years before they made a single dime that they could send home. So I wanted to include that in the story. This is the kind of stuff that companies like, good companies like Adidas and Patagonia, recognize that this is happening in their supply chains, and they really want to get rid of it, but they don't often know how.
You were kind of in the position of the journalist in the story. I mean, how did you get access to the workers?
Yeah, you know, through the years, I've kind of developed an acumen for investigative journalism. I've learned how to develop contacts, and I've learned how to find fixers and learn to meet people who I can trust. And so in the case of Malaysia, you know, and often that comes through NGOs. So I will do some internet research and, you know, talk to people I know in the country and say, look, who's doing work on this subject? And then I'll talk to them and I'll say, look, I'm writing a book and I need access to X, Y, and Z. You know, in this case, I need to meet some garment workers, you know, in Kuala Lumpur. And so it just so happened that a nonprofit called Tenaganita, working in Malaysia on forced labor, an amazing organization. It's been around for quite some years fighting, despite the government not being helpful in Malaysia. They've made a lot of great strides. And one of their young investigators agreed to be kind of a fixer for me and get me in the door through his contacts to meet some workers who were victims of forced labor. So, yeah, so we went at night, you know, to their dormitory because they work, you know, 10 to 12 hours a day. So the only time you can meet them is at night in their dormitory. And, you know, so we walked into this sketchy part of town and sat down with them and, you know, had a conversation with my fixer being the translator. And they told me their story. And it was deeply affecting. You know, many of the stories that I carry in my heart through the years that I've developed in my research, I wonder sometimes, you know, if I'm doing enough. I wish I could do more for these people. But I've committed myself to try to write stories that have an impact. And I hope that, you know, whether or not they can make an impact on those individuals, that they have an impact on the world.
Before we go, I guess I want to ask you the big picture question, which is, if this is a systemic problem, you know, you talk about this as being really an issue about retail and globalization. We spoke in the beginning about the factors that are driving companies to squeeze their workers, to cut the corners, and to engage in these reprehensible practices. What is it going to take? I mean, you know, Patagonia may be able to charge more money, but fast fashion is based on a cheap clothing model. Does this mean getting rid of fast fashion, or is there something else that can be done?
That's a great question. There are a couple of different things that I would say. I mean, number one, From a consumer standpoint, do we need to get rid of fast fashion? Yes. We actually need to do with fashion what we've done with food. So back when I was a kid in the 90s, McDonald's was all the rage. And, you know, for me, like the coolest thing in the world was to go get a Big Mac. So fast food was all the rage in the 90s. And what is McDonald's doing today? They're selling kale salad because the culture has slowed food down. And so, you know, McDonald's is no longer, you know, pushing the envelope on fast food. They're trying to find ways to compete with the slow food producers. I believe that's the ultimate solution from a consumer standpoint. You know, we need to recover as consumers something of the mentality that our grandparents had. And I'm not trying to be stuffy and stodgy here. There's actually something beautiful about it. Let's recover some of the glamour and the love that we have for clothing by buying things that we, you know, will spend a little more on, but that we will keep for years and love, just like our grandparents did. So when I was, when I went to law school, my grandfather dug around in his attic for a beautiful cashmere top coat. I was living in California, coming to the East for law school, needed a coat to go over a suit, and, you know, didn't have any money. And so he was like, look, I've got this beautiful coat that I bought 35 years ago. It doesn't have a single busted seam. It's still beautiful. Here, you can have it. And I have that in my closet to this day. And every time I wear that, I think of him. He's passed now. But I think of him, and I remember the gift, and it's a beautiful piece. And so he spent money on that, but it lasted. It endured. It's not something that dies in three washes like a lot of the things that we buy in fast fashion. So, you know, we need to actually wean ourselves as consumers off of our addiction to fast fashion and recover something of the beauty and the glamour of clothing, you know, in a day when it was made to last. So that's one thing. The other thing from a corporate side is I believe that a big company, I mean, if one of the really big companies decided to make part of its masthead promise what is, you know, essentially the promise of Patagonia or Adidas, and that is social responsibility is at the core of what we do. What you're buying from us is as clean as we can make it, and we are fighting tooth and nail every day to make it as clean as possible. That's where the culture is going. That's where millennial consumers already are. That's where Gen Z consumers will be when they become the consumers of the future. I think that if a big company made, you know, the first step to say we're going to make this part of our core promise to consumers, I think everybody else would get in line. And it would actually make money for everybody. So there are two solutions that I lay out there. They're big picture solutions. I'm hopeful right now. Fast fashion is driving everything. But I think that over the course of time with consumer change and consumer mentality change, you know, we can actually see a different kind of consumerism.
Well, I hope you're right there, Corbin Addison. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
Corbin Addison is the author of several acclaimed novels in addition to A Harvest of Thorns. He's also an attorney and human rights activist. Read an excerpt from A Harvest of Thorns at writersvoice.net. Next up, a new documentary about deadly hazards for China's young workers who make our smartphones. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When you gaze down lovingly at your shiny new smartphone, do you ever think of the young worker who's dying right now of leukemia? The one who cleaned your smartphone's screen on a factory line in China with the benzene that is now taking her life? I didn't think so. Neither did I, until I watched Heather White's explosive undercover look at China's electronics industry and how it's killing and maiming workers as young as their early teens. An international expert on global corporate social responsibility, White's film Complicit follows the workers whose lives are being cut short because of the flagrant disregard for worker health endemic in the electronics industry. She co-produced the film with Lin Zhang. Well, Heather White, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This film, Complicit, takes a very powerful look at the electronics industry in China and the hazards to the workers there. Complicit implies that we are all complicit. First of all, talk a little bit about the title and your choice of it.
One of the main messages of the film is to convey to consumers that we're all a part of a system of globalized production that takes place largely in China, where workers are being poisoned, where their rights are not being respected, where they're not even aware of the toxic chemicals that they're handling as a part of their job, and as a result are being hospitalized and in some cases getting leukemia and dying, in part because the production has moved over to Asia. We have very little idea. It's a hidden system for the most part, and yet we're driving it as consumers because of the purchases that we're making on a regular basis of our phones and electronic devices and our upgrades, and because of the pricing that's in place by the factories and the global brands. There's not much room for workers to advocate for themselves in an environment like China, which is an authoritarian regime, doesn't allow freedom of association or trade unions. So we're all kind of caught up in this web of globalization, denial of human rights, worker occupational illness and disease, and our product choices.
Heather White never thought she would do a film. Instead, she was working on a book.
And as a result of what I'd been working on there, got the opportunity to go and research the mega factories that are now producing the bulk of the world's electronic products that are located right outside of Hong Kong in China in the Pearl River Delta area in the major cities of Shenzhen and Guangzhou. I first began by following up on a newspaper article I'd seen several years before that mentioned that there were dozens of Chinese teenagers who'd been hospitalized and were paralyzed and some were in comas because of exposure to toxic chemicals in the export factories that they'd been working in, and the factories were refusing to pay their medical costs, and the government had to step in to create some public hospitals and clinics to treat them. So I decided I would find out where those occupational illness clinics were in that area and just randomly walk through the halls and the hospital wards to see who was in there and to find out if there were still teenagers, and if there were, what had they been working on, and were there any connections back to global brands or U.S. companies. So that's basically how the project began in January of 2013. And after just a week and a half with a colleague of walking through these hospitals, we were so shocked by what we'd found in terms of the number of young people, their ages. About half of them had lost their right hands due to faulty machinery making some of the housings for the smartphones and devices. And complicit doesn't actually include any of those workers or their cases, because we decided we were going to have to make a decision between focusing on whether it was the leukemia issue or whether it was the loss of young people's hands in the factories. And we've made the decision to go with the benzene and hexane as the focus of the film. But there were so many people in the hospital that had been working on cell phones, and we were blown away, basically, and decided we had to make a documentary film and do it right away so we could come back to the U.S. and start working with NGOs and advocacy organizations to sound an alarm about what was happening in the factories, because I had seen nothing about it in any previous reports, and this was a scandal of global proportions.
These are kids 17, 18, 19 years old. One of the things that surprised me is occupational disease usually takes decades, occupational cancers usually take decades to develop, and yet these kids were developing them within months or a few, just a few years.
Yeah, it's really shocking. And what I was able to put together is that it appears that they're being exposed in such high concentrations to the chemicals like benzene and hexane, that their bodies are just basically overwhelmed and they're developing these illnesses very quickly. The young women that are featured in the film, in most cases, had only been working in the factory for about 3 months before they became paralyzed, and 39 of them were put in the hospital, basically all together, and spent the next 2 years together recovering. And in the case of the workers who had leukemia, they'd been working between 2 and 3 years before they developed leukemia, which again, like you said, is a very rapid onset for a disease that sometimes can take up to a decade to manifest itself, but they were being exposed in such huge concentrations. For example, benzene's international standard of exposure is currently at 1 part per million as a solvent, and some of the bottles that workers had been using that was a mixture of benzene with other solvents was like 30% benzene, or somewhere between 20% to 30% benzene in cases that workers who knew something about the chemical had told us. So they're being exposed in such huge amounts that it's no surprise that they've gotten sick as quickly as they have, because it's being used so irresponsibly by the factories.
So instead of 1 part per million, it's 30 parts per 100.
Right.
Tell us what the benzene and the other chemical, the one that caused the paralysis, is, and hexane, what are they being used for?
Well, one of the things that's so shocking about the film is how unnecessary it is that these kids are being exposed to these chemicals at all, because their jobs as the youngest people in the workforce in the factories and the least skilled, I mean, some of the kids went into the factory at ages 14 and 15, they're just put to work wiping stuff because they haven't been really trained, or they didn't study engineering, et cetera, at a vocational school, or they hadn't finished high school. So they're just put to work sitting down and wiping 700 to 800 screens per day, or wiping down the plastic parts or the motherboards to make sure everything's clean so that can move to the next stage of assembly. And previously, the solvents that were being used were not that toxic, isopropyl alcohol. Of course, any chemical can become toxic if used in very high concentrations in an environment where there's no ventilation, which is often the case in the Chinese factories where we were interviewing the workers. But these are chemicals that are being used primarily because they're produced in China, they're cheap, the government is not taking an aggressive enforcement position in terms of making sure that these workplaces are not exposing teens to hazardous chemicals. China actually has a law that protects young workers ages 19 and under from using any chemicals, and they're also supposed to be working reduced hours, and there are quite a few regulations in place that the factories just consistently ignore. And so what we're having, in fact, is a situation where factories are just ignoring guidelines, using the cheapest chemicals, not telling the kids what they're being exposed to, and also not offering the proper types of masks and gloves protection that would at least help in terms of the levels of exposure. And again, they're using poorly ventilated environments where there's no chance for these chemicals to dissipate, and they're also being exposed to them for 12 hours a day continuously.
12 hours a day seems like an awful long day for any worker, much less ones that are this young.
Yes, and they're supposed to be protected. The factories are supposed to follow rules regarding working hours for young people, but they generally don't. And in the interviews with our workers in the film, as well as with workers who've been interviewed for the last 15 years in China, they always report that they worked 6 or 7 days a week, 12-hour shifts. So this is just an endemic problem with having production in China.
And you're listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking with Heather White about the documentary film she co-produced. It's called Complicit, and it's about the hazards in the Chinese electronics industry. And tell us, what is the position of China in the global electronics industry supply chain?
Well, as we show in the film, China is the producer of the majority of the world's electronics products right now, with at least 70% of global production, and approximately 90% of the world's cell phones have at least some components made in China, if not the entire phone. Samsung, which is the largest brand in Korea and also actually the largest cell phone brand in terms of volume worldwide, they produce in China as well, but the majority of the company's production is in South Korea, which is a democracy. They have activist groups and organizations that can bring claims to the government when workers have been poisoned. Families can sue. It's an entirely different environment there, so that the companies can be held responsible in the cases where workers are being poisoned or seriously injured. But in China, that's just not the case.
And so Samsung goes to China to get its work done. Is that right?
Yes, and also because of the way the production has been organized now, there's so many subcontractors and small shops that are also based in China, and they produce the raw materials as well, that it just makes sense for any global brand to be producing in China in terms of their access to the skilled labor force and the raw materials. However, I'm not saying that I believe that these brands should be producing in China, because China is a totalitarian dictatorship that keeps workers so disempowered that any company that posts its code of conduct on its website saying that we respect workers' rights and we will not do business with manufacturers that don't allow freedom of association and collective bargaining, and all of the global cell phone brands actually have this language in their codes of conduct posted publicly, you can't produce in China and be in compliance with your own code of conduct, because none of these things are actually in place and workers have no voice.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Heather White. She's a filmmaker and longtime China expert working on the issues of worker health and safety in China, issues of ethical supply chains. In the film, you follow a number of different people, as you've talked about, different workers, young workers. You've talked about a group of workers who got leukemia. There's one story that's especially affecting, I would say, emotionally affecting, and that is of a young man, Ming Quin Pong. He actually commits suicide, and it's a powerful story because you interview him and his father. Tell us a little bit about him and his dad.
This family really touched me very deeply, and I'm still in touch with them, because the level of commitment and the desperation of the parents trying to help their son through his chemotherapy and hopefully have a chance for survival after he had been given a very serious terminal diagnosis for occupational leukemia was just so moving in terms of what the family went through. They came from a village about 800 miles away, moved to the area where the factory was located, where Quin Pong had gotten sick, and did everything they could to help him with his treatment and to take care of him day and night. The parents, the brother, his wife, and the baby had all moved into a very small apartment that was about 450 square feet. And they spent day and night, basically, taking care of Quin Pong and trying to help him through the process, because it took about a year for him to obtain his occupational disease diagnosis from his employer, which is one of the largest Dutch semiconductor equipment manufacturers. And they do business all over Silicon Valley, and they even have an office in Silicon Valley that I visited and managed to interview one of the VPs during our production. In China, when a worker gets leukemia, they have to go through a medical diagnosis process before the factory becomes legally obligated to pay their medical expenses. And what we found with all of the workers we interviewed is that the factories do everything they can to drag out this process so they're not going to have to start paying for the hospital expenses. And in a more cynical view, maybe they're just trying to run out the clock. So in Quin Pong's case, he he didn't actually get his diagnosis for a year after he started feeling sick, which means he lost a year of treatment and a year of chemo because the family couldn't afford it. And so by that time, by the time he got the diagnosis, it was already getting to be too late. And so when we first met him in 2013, he was already very ill and recovering, but not very successfully, from a bone marrow transplant. And then things just went downhill from there. And he was very depressed. And finally, in early 2015, he committed suicide.
And how did the family take that?
Well, naturally, the family was devastated, and they immediately gave up the apartment, moved back to their home in the countryside, and have been trying to put their lives back together. And fortunately, they have another child who's an adult, and there's a grandson, so it gives them something positive to focus on. But for me, it was just a very frustrating experience trying to get the company to provide him with a second medical opinion and possibly some improved medical care, because where he lived was only a 5-minute walk from the Hong Kong border, and they could have walked across to Hong Kong to get care at a much higher level hospital. And I reached out to a doctor at Harvard Medical School who had contacts in Hong Kong and was happy to arrange for him to be seen and possibly be treated there. And when I reached out to the company to ask them if they would be willing to underwrite the costs of that, I never heard an answer back, and they stopped communicating with me.
The title of your film, Heather White, is Complicit. One of the major companies, certainly not the only one, but one of the major companies that gets its product produced there, the iPhone, is Apple. And they deny that they have any complicity in the exposures of these workers to these hazardous chemicals that's making them deathly sick. I wonder if you could talk about that.
When we posted our first trailer online in early 2014, a couple of global organizations, as well as a group in the U.S. called Green America, launched a campaign to put pressure on Apple as well as other cell phone brands. But basically, they were focusing on Apple. And they had a campaign called badapple.org that you can still find online to try to persuade Apple to ban benzene and N-hexane, the two chemicals we focus on in the film, from their global supplier networks. And they did do that. By August of 2014, they announced that they were going to issue a ban to their first-tier suppliers. That means their primary manufacturers, the ones who are packing and shipping their products and who are the main factories that they work with, who are included in their annual supplier responsibility report. So that's about a third of their production in China. Those groups felt that that didn't go far enough, and they're still advocating for a total ban on benzene and N-hexane, including the subcontractors. And the workers in the film that we interviewed primarily were working for the subcontractors in this massive supply network where there's a huge web of small factories surrounding these first-tier manufacturers for Apple, all feeding product into them every day. These factories that are the main suppliers, in some cases, have 200,000 to 300,000 workers now. I mean, these are mega factories with their own police stations, with everything that you imagine a city might have.
And they have these subcontractors who are basically... There seems to be a plausible deniability situation because Apple can say they don't contract with them. Is that right?
That's true. As of right now, Apple and the other brands don't have any legal liability for what happens with the workforce at their subcontractors, and they don't even have to acknowledge who those subcontractors are, and in some cases they might not even know, because these are thousands of factories in order to meet the global demand from Apple products. So what I think needs to happen is for Apple and others to spend a lot more resources on the ground in the neighborhoods where all these factories are located to have a much more active presence looking at these issues of occupational health and safety for workers. It's not rocket science. You know, they can go into a facility and see that the windows are sealed and that the doors are locked or that workers are locked in or that they're using hazardous solvents. The workers in our film, some of them actually went back to the factory after they got out of the hospital after 2 years, back to their same jobs, and are still using N-hexane again.
Now, there is an inspiring story that you also tell in this film, in Complicit, and that is the story of the organizations, the advocacy organizations that are fighting against the situation, are helping the workers. One of them that you talk about in the film is led by a worker who got cancer as a result of occupational exposures. Tell us about these organizations and this one in particular.
The organization that our main character, Yi Yeting, works for is called Labor Action China, and they're based in Hong Kong. They have activities and do advocacy and provide resources for workers across the border in China, but they can't operate in China officially. And one of the messages of the film is showing to the audience that these advocacy groups can't even operate above board in China anymore because the government has been systematically shutting them down, pursuing a campaign to crack down basically on all civil society organizations over the last 6 years. So at the beginning of our filming process, 12 organizations had been shut down the previous year, and some of the people that we interviewed had had to move all of their activities to their homes, and then when the police found out that they were operating out of their homes, they pressured their landlords and got them evicted. So in our story, following our main character, E, he actually gets evicted twice during the course of our interviewing him because his landlord is under pressure by the government to just make his life as difficult as possible. So he had to move twice during the course of our making the film, and each time it was to a poorer neighborhood. And the last neighborhood he was living in Guangzhou, before we ended our filming, was such a toxic, polluted environment that I decided I really didn't want to have to go back there again and would prefer to interview him somewhere else in the city because of the just terrible air. As you are probably aware, there's a lot of air pollution in China, and in some of the neighborhoods, it's worse than in other places, and I felt that he was living in one of the worst public health areas that I had ever seen in China, and I've been to China over 30 times.
And he's got a young family as well. Now, I want to ask you in just the minute or so that we have left, how can listeners, or is there anything that listeners can do to become less complicit with this, to help the workers in their fight for justice?
Well, there are quite a few things that listeners can do if they're concerned about the issues. One is to call the manufacturers of their cell phone and also their service providers and tell them that these are issues that matter to them, because we're involved with a lot of different groups who are putting pressure at several different points of leverage with manufacturers, with the service providers, and if they hear from their users that these are issues that are important to them, it could make a difference. There's also an electronics challenge that will be sent to the brands that's on the website for the film, complicitfilm.org. We also have a Facebook page, and we hope people will watch the film. We're going to be having our USA premiere in June in New York at Lincoln Center as part of the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, and we've gotten some offers from distributors, so we expect to have it available for people to watch it online sometime later in 2017.
Well, that's terrific, and we will link to the Facebook page and to the film's website at writersvoice.net. Heather White, you've been talking to us about your terrific film, Complicit. It's about the terrible hazards, occupational hazards, faced by workers in the electronics industry in China. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you very much.
Heather White. You can find links to the film Complicit, as well as the other ones that we mentioned, at writersvoice.net, and you can also watch the trailer to the film. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.